Prepare for the chills. Prepare for the fun when Penobscot Theater Company presents the return of the hit Broadway musical, Little Shop of Horrors. For Seymour Crailborn, life on Skid Row has never been easy. He's down on his luck, and he just can't seem to catch a break. And then, suddenly, without warning, there is a total eclipse of the sun, and into his life comes Audrey II, a strange and unusual plant. This gleeful and gruesome tribute to sci-fi horror B-movies has a toe-tapping doo-wop score that'll get you on your feet. Little Shop of Horrors runs June 13th to July 14th. Tickets are selling fast, so get yours today by calling 207-942-3333 or at penobscottheater.org. And whatever you do, don't feed the plants!
Back here on Dad Tip, we were talking about Dwight Yoakam during the break. He's so good.
Great phrasing, great enunciation.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's... I always liked Dwight Yoakam a lot since I first saw him playing it on a TV show with Buck Owens. I think the first time I saw him.
We were talking about what a good actor he is, too. Did you ever see Sling Blade?
Yes.
Which I thought was, among other things, one of John Ritter's greatest performances.
Absolute
he was so good in that.
Sling Blade.
Yeah, which was interesting. I was reading something the other day that Billy Bob Thornton and John Ritter were good friends. And when he had the script and everything, but when it came time to shoot the movie, they did their first scene together. Ritter couldn't stop laughing because he had never heard Billy Bob do the voice he did of that character.
I did not know that.
And Ritter was just breaking up constantly. And he said, no, that's how the character's going to be played. Anyway, it's 4:32. It's downtown on a Wednesday afternoon. Time for Sports Lit 101 and a book we've talked a little bit about, but we're going to get into the nitty gritty of it today. A wonderful new book called Perfect Eloquence, An Appreciation of Vin Scully, edited by Tom Hofarth. And boy, what a wonderful look at, I think anybody would agree, the greatest baseball broadcaster of all time.
And what I'd love when the book, you knew it halfway through the book. When it was over, you said to yourself, damn, what a hell of a guy.
Yeah.
I mean, we were talking before, and I want people who read Perfect Eloquence to really pay attention to the way it's set up. 9 chapters, each one being an inning. And every and a chapter is introduced by Tom Hofarth. But then these are short essays. None of them are more than 3 or 4 pages long. Some of them shorter. By all kinds of people. I mean, there's Bob Costas. There's Annette Bening. There's Sandy Koufax. There's Leslie Visser, speaking of people that were just on the radio here recently. And what we learned is that in the whole career of Vin Scully, growing up in Hell's Kitchen and going to Fordham University and helping start WFUV, one of the most important radio stations in the history of New York, at 22, calling professional baseball games and being under the wing of Red Barber. That's all great. But when he parks his car at the golf course and the guy says, good evening, Mr. Scully, he says, oh, no, call me Vin.
Yeah.
And doesn't want any of the pretense. The guy was modest to a fault.
And one of the things I love in this book, so many of the notes that he wrote to people through the years.
His consideration of, you know, he'd hear someone was sick or someone hadn't gone their way. His willingness to have people up to the booth before the game, you know, hear about some young kid that had a bad break come up. But what I really loved is 45 minutes before every game, he called his wife.
Yeah.
Went outside of the booth and called his wife to see how Sandy's day was going because he was on the road so much and traveled so much. He was never missed Mass on Sunday.
Nope.
A man of regular habits. I thought it was fascinating that he had donated to every Republican candidate until Trump. that he was at heart always a New Yorker. He said, you know, though he lived in L.A. for all those years, he almost didn't go west with the Dodgers. Mm. If he hadn't, he would have ended up being the Yankees announcer, the Mets announcer. Yeah. I mean, somebody would have picked him up. But what I found so fascinating was that you'd be reading a story, and then 20 essays later, someone else would relate to the same story and remember it in the same way, so that you knew that all of these remembrances were what happened. And I just love the fact that at the beginning of the book, there's a list of his accomplishments. And I just thought I would read this one, okay? 2016, after calling an estimated 10,000 games, including 20 no-hitters and three perfect games, Scully makes good on his decision to retire after his 67th season, just short of his 89th birthday. His last Dodger Stadium game is calling a walk-off homer by Charlie Culberson as the Dodgers clinch the NL West title. His final game comes at San Francisco's A&T Park on October 2nd as he does all nine innings simulcast on TV and radio. What people who are not great baseball fans may not know is Vin Scully worked alone.
Yeah.
He would occasionally, for like national broadcasts, for World Series and things like that, football, other sports, he did be paired up with somebody. But he did a 2.5 hour rain delay by himself. Nobody in the studio. No, let's go back to the station, whatever. And people who heard that, and I certainly did not. It was only on in L.A., or I guess it was only on in L.A. Said that it seemed to just fly by.
Yeah,
2.5 hours.
Well, and I love the story. And I can't remember his name, but the broadcaster who took over for Scully, who talked about how he approached it on the day that Vin passed away. And he said, you know, I wanted to honor Vin's approach to the game, which was to certainly find time to tell stories, but also honor every pitch. And yeah. I can't miss a pitch while I'm talking about how great Vin was.
Yeah. And, you know, that one of the things that I remember was a game that Scully was broadcasting on national TV. And, I think it was the Dodgers against the Cardinals. I don't remember, but it was two storied franchises. And between every pitch, instead of, well, his ERA is 3.12, except on Saturday afternoons, and it rained on the Friday before, and which is, you know, he never gave you any of that garbage. It wasn't into the sabermetrics and stuff. He would remember what a guy was hitting or things like that. But what he would tell us a story about, of course, this may remind Pedro of the time when he was 16 years old and was hit a ball into a nest of bees and almost died, right? And he would have these stories. And someone said to him, Vin, what is it you do in all these hours before the game? And he said, oh, I prepare my ad-libs. I thought that was fabulous. His homework was legendary. I mean, people said he just did his homework. He knew everything that was going to happen that he could possibly control.
And he knew about players. He knew about their families.
Oh, yeah, their children's names.
Yeah.
And I was really touched by one of the stories where a woman who had admired him for years, an older woman, I you'll remember this too, approached him, I think, at church and wanted to get his autograph or something, and he wanted to get hers too because she had been listening for so many years, doing so many things. People said that wasn't a put on, it's just the way he was. And he loved applesauce. And if the clubhouse guys could get Vin Scully applesauce every game, he never forgot them, left him a tip or the like. And they talked about what a generous tipper he was, not because to draw attention to himself, but he'd grown up hard scrabble, you know, as with a single mom, as he said, a fiery Irish temperament when he was younger. The beauty of the way Hofar set this up is all of these people can't be blowing smoke.
Right.
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 There are just so many people telling the truth, and so many people saying, I heard Vin Scully on the radio. That's why I became a sports broadcaster. And, you know, he's out there with Chick Hearn and all these guys, legendary people a lot of the time that he's broadcasting in L.A. But he was famous in New York. Mm. And then he was in L.A. for, I think, 60 years. And that is in itself remarkable. And that he had relationships with managers, with players, with umpires. Bruce Fleming writes in here about what a great announcer Scully was and how he didn't try and upstage umpires. He didn't second guess things. He would talk about what happened and not interject. You know, and it was just so refreshing since, and I think brought to the head by Angel Hernandez finally retiring, that he loved the game of baseball. He didn't think the game of baseball was bigger than life or more important than other things in life, but he knew how important it was, and he honored it in a way that I think more people might consider doing who broadcast today. I don't need the hot take. What I need is to hear the game, to see the game. And I would always rather, I prefer baseball on the radio. I mean, summer night, sitting on the porch, listening to a baseball game, that's good stuff. But I would say Vin Scully, Ned Martin, Chuck Thompson, Red Barber, they're my top four. And Scully is and it's not 1A, 1B, 1C, it's well, 1, 2,
down. And the word eloquence, I think, is so crucial to talking about Scully because he was so well-spoken. There were no need for catchphrases or anything like that. He knew when to get out of the way and let the game speak for itself. He knew the power of silence, but he knew just the right words to say to set the tone and make you feel like you were there.
And yeah, here's one of those. I marked this for today. Football is to baseball as blackjack is to bridge. One is the quick jolt, the other deliberate, slow-paced game of skill, but never was a sport more ideally suited to television than baseball. It's all there in front of you. It's theater, really. The star is the spotlight on the mound, the supporting cast fanned out around them, the mathematical precision of the game moving with the kind of inevitability of Greek tragedy with a Greek chorus in the bleachers. Mm. Yeah, nobody talks like that today.
Well, let's give a little listen here.
Yeah.
That's not a very good. Let me see if I can find a better audio quality call than that, because it was such a great call.
Sandy Koufax perfect game.
Sandy
yes.
Koufax perfect game, which to me, if you listen to that, it is the greatest baseball play-by-play call of all time.
I could never argue against that. That's for sure. And you know, you and I have been around long enough to have heard some great ones. Ned Martin saying that Willie Horton's swing took the last breath of air out of the ballpark. One of the best things I ever heard.
All right, let me see if I can get a little bit of this one. I think might be a little bit better.
In his sensational career, has Sandy Koufax walked out to the mound to pitch a fateful ninth where he turned in a no-hitter. But tonight, September the 9th, 1965, he made the toughest walk of his career, I'm sure. Because through eight innings, he has pitched a perfect game. He has struck out 11. He has retired 24 consecutive batters. And the first man he will look at is catcher Chris Krug, big right-hand hitter. Fly to center, grounded to short. Dick Trusewski is now at second base, and Koufax ready and delivers. Curve ball for a strike. Oh, and one, the count to Chris Krug. Out on deck to pinch hit is one of the men we mentioned earlier as a possible Joey Amalfitano. Here's the strike one pitch to Krug. Fastball swung on and missed. Strike two.
It's just that musical quality of his voice that nobody else ever had. Let's listen to a little bit later in that final inning.
Foul to the plate. You're hearing about that one, I think.
Oh, I lost it again. Man, oh, man, stop that. Let's see here. Let me get it back.
And that's gone unnoticed. Sandy ready in the strike one pitch. Very high, and he lost his hat. He really forced that one. That's only the second time tonight where I have had the feeling that Sandy threw instead of pitched, trying to get that little extra. And that time he tried so hard his hat fell off. He took an extremely long stride to the plate, and Torborg had to go up to get it. 1-1 to Harvey Keene. Now he's ready. Fastball high, ball two. You can't blame a man for pushing just a little bit now. Sandy backs off, mops his forehead, runs his left index finger along his forehead, dries it off.
Those details.
Unbelievable.
All the while, Keene just waiting. Now Sandy looks in. Into his windup, and the 2-1 pitch to Keene. Swung on and missed. Strike two. It is 9:46 p.m. 2-2 to Harvey Keene. One strike away. Sandy into his windup. Here's the pitch. Swung on and missed. A perfect game.
And then lets the crowd tell you the rest of it. He was the best.
And then the greatest summary that you'll ever hear in broadcasting coming up.
Yeah.
On the scoreboard in right field, it is 9:46 p.m. in the City of the Angels, Los Angeles, California. And a crowd of 29,139. Just sitting in to see the only pitcher in baseball history to hurl four no-hit, no-run games. He has done it four straight years, and now he capped it on his fourth no-hitter. He made it a perfect game. And Sandy Koufax, whose name will always remind you of strikeouts, did it with a flourish. He struck out the last six consecutive batters.
What a game.
Yeah, and think of all the stuff he didn't say.
Right.
That makes it so great. You know, people talk about the musical quality of that, and you know what's really true? And you and I know this because we know music well enough. It ain't the notes you play. It's the spaces between them and the ones you leave out, right? And that's what I always thought made him brilliant. And I remember Chris Berman saying, when he got all the praise for when Ripken broke the record and he just let it go and didn't say anything, he said, I only thought of Vin Scully calling Sandy Koufax perfect game. Let the crowd tell you what happened.
And he never lost control of his emotion.
No.
You know, the voice would rise a little bit.
Yeah.
But it would never, you know, you're never pinning your VU meters, as we say. It
yep.
was just always in control. But boy, the book is so wonderful, and so many great stories about Vin the broadcaster, but Vin the person.
I love Sandy Koufax's quote on the back cover. Vin was more than a broadcaster; he was my friend, and Scully seemed to be a friend of. I mean, people get traded; they were still friends. They'd be an executive, and they'd lose their job with the Dodgers and go somewhere else. He remained in contact with them, in touch with people, didn't let those friendships go away. And you know, it's a who's who in here in many places. But as you and I were talking off air, there are notes in here from people that had low level jobs that were treated as if they were the best baseball player in the world, the best executive in the world, the best whatever in the world. And that Scully never, ever changed. I think there's some, I thought Joe Buck's essay in here was really good. Bob Costas's was really good. Al Michaels, who I'm not all that fond of, I thought his was really good. But there were just some other ones by people that I had no idea who they were. And I would read them and I'd think, man, I wish I'd been there. I look at this now and I think, man, how come I never got to meet Vin Scully? Bryan Cranston's is great.
Yeah, oh, it too. Is. Absolutely. It's so many. Yeah. A lot of friends of downtown in this book. Just the blurbs alone. Ron Shelton.
Yep.
You mentioned Leslie Visser, Rick Riley, Brad Belukian, Eric Sherman, Jason Turbo, all friends of downtown.
And I love how Ray Charles wanted to meet him.
Yeah.
More than any.
Yeah.
If you can wake it so I can meet Vin Scully, you know, Fabulous.
And we're hoping to catch up with Tom Hofarth, the editor.
Yeah, he's more than happy to come on. I have to just arrange a date with him, probably sometime like maybe the last week of June.
That sounds great.
Yeah. Really fun book. Perfect Eloquence.
449 here on Downtown.